Good afternoon, everyone. It's Thursday afternoon, and we're looking at an article from Bering Drift. Bill, how'd you find this website? I never even heard of it before.
It was an accident, total accident. I think I saw it on a Facebook feed and went to the link, and timing was proper given the errand that we were given today to find a good article on this topic. So here's a guy named Brian, I guess, Shoneman. Let's go with Shoneman. And he's worked for the Fairfax County, Virginia Electoral Board. He's apparently a noted attorney, small business owner, and has a law degree from Catholic University.
All right.
And the website is Bering Drift, Virginia's Conservative Voice. And the title of the article is Myths versus Facts in the Syrian Refugee Issue.
The recent attacks in Paris have ignited a firestorm of controversy about the refugees in the United States. Based on information that has been released in this still ongoing investigation, at least one of the Paris bombers was fingerprinted in Greece and may have posed as a refugee. This has led to an outcry here in America. Unfortunately, what has been feeding into this outcry is a massive amount of misreporting on the issues of issue of refugees, both in the United States and elsewhere. And this has been exacerbated by incorrect and misleading comments from elected officials and candidates for office. This is too important an issue to allow prejudices, nativism, and misinformation posing as fact to color our objective policy ideas. Try to cut through some of the false narratives. Here is a list of myths and facts about the Syrian refugees, American refugee policy, and other issues in the news lately. Once we can all agree as to the facts, we can begin determining what, if anything, we need to do here at home on this issue. Myth number one, there is a flood of Syrian refugees entering the United States. This myth has been making the rounds and was given credence yesterday by Donald Trump in a tweet that he sent out, but this just isn't true. According to the State Department, since October 2014, 1,869 Syrians have entered the United States since 2014. The bulk of those came during
fiscal year 2015.
The New York Times used slightly different numbers in this article with a map showing relocations claiming 1,854 have entered the United States since 2012. According to the Virginia Department of Social Services, 25 Syrian refugees have been relocated to Virginia in 2015, and none so far in 2016, which began October 1st. There is no flood of refugees. Given the tens and hundreds of thousands of refugees being accepted in Europe and the Middle East, this is a relative trickle.
All right, so let's talk about myth one. So I understand this point completely, which is 1,800 in the light of the, what's our population, 300 million?
Right. Yeah, 309 million, I think, according to 2010 census. Yeah.
Right, so that's nothing, right? I mean, it's virtually nothing. But then the reverse to that is it only takes one.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it was like, what, nine? Was it nine or something that killed 140 people in Paris?
In Paris.
Last week, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, you look at it and you go, 1,800, that's nothing. That's we shouldn't even be concerned about it. But the reverse to that is, should we be concerned at all then? Because based on those numbers, there's not even a conversation to be had.
Well, I suppose that's true. But I don't know how we would ever have immigrants of any kind if we were wanting a zero defect sort of policy.
True.
You know, I think with anyone from anywhere, you assume some risk. And since America generally assumes tons of risk through several factors of their own society, I don't think this is much of a shocker.
We assume risk with our own citizens being swayed to the other beliefs.
Right. I think we found, maybe it was this article, maybe I'm spoiling, I don't think so, but I read yesterday that 9 Minnesota men have been arrested for trying to go join ISIS. And that's the ones that they stopped. Mm-hmm. And they've already got documented evidence of some who've been successful and have died on the battlefield for ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
So we have our own that are trying to get away from here that we should be concerned about.
You know, of course, the part that I agree with here is...
Yeah.
Sorry, I mean to cut you off.
Okay.
It is, you know, Trump and others like him and other memes and everything else, they do try to run to the extreme scare tactic idea.
Mm-hmm.
They're pouring in it right now.
Mm-hmm. But,
That's not what's happening. That's why the House is trying to stop this now before anybody comes in. They're trying to get this thing passed before December to stop the funding for this program so that the refugees can't start coming in January. So it's this, you know, we have to take this extreme position with everything that we have. And, you know, they're moving in next door to you and they're going to be there to rape your daughters and kill your sons. I mean, it's like, all right, I understand we've got a risk here. I understand there's something we need to talk about, but let's not distort the facts of what's going on. I think that's a point that I take from that I think is pretty good.
Yeah.
All right, number two. Myth number two. The Obama administration wants to allow hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees to relocate to the United States. This myth has been all over the place, far longer than the blowback from the Paris bombings. As Glenn Kessler notes in his Washington Post Fast Check column, three of the top 10 Republican presidential candidates have repeated this myth in recent days. Donald Trump says, our president wants to take in 250,000 from Syria. Dr. Ben Carson, when the president says things like, you know, through the executive order, I'm going to bring 100,000 people in here from Syria. And Carly Fiorina says, I am angry that President Obama unilaterally decides that we'll accept up to 100,000 Syrian refugees while his administration admits we cannot determine their ties to terrorism. There is nothing accurate about these claims. The Obama administration, by congressional authorization and not by executive order, sets the total number of refugees permitted to relocate to the United States each year. That number has hovered around 70,000 total for the past few years, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service. The president has been under pressure to increase that number, given the number of refugees creating crises around the globe, including Syria, Africa, and Iraq. He has pledged to increase that number, we accept, gradually from 70 to 85,000 in 2016 and 100,000 in 2017. As the Post noted here in a September article that you can follow on the link, the president has ordered an increase in the total number of refugees from any country and has a set goal of allowing 10,000 Syrians to relocate here in the next fiscal year. 10,000 is a much smaller number than 200,000.
Right, but the 200,000, I mean, two of them said 100,000, and by his own paragraph, he admits that by 2017, we'll be at 100,000.
Right.
So is it a complete myth?
It's a...
But he's saying 100,000 is total.
Total, yeah.
From anywhere, and that, but limiting 10,000 to the Syrians.
Mm-hmm. So,
the
again,
authors...
Right.
I guess the point is that they're coming from somewhere anyways. Isn't that what the author is saying? They're coming from somewhere anyways already.
We've been doing it every year anyway. It's not like this is
something brand new. We've been doing 70,000 every year for a while. So it's, you know, and of the 70,000 over the past few years, only, what, 1,800 or whatever were Syrian. So, you know, yeah, he's increased, you know, President Obama wants to increase it from that to 10,000. Next year, or allow 10,000 of the 85,000, I guess, because he wants to up it. Mm-hmm. So he wants to allow, really, what's that, 10 times more? Or, well, not quite, but.
Which needs congressional authorization, is what.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right, number three.
We don't vet Syrian refugees before they come here, and the FBI director says we can't vet them. A variety of elected officials have claimed that we don't vet or can't vet Syrian refugees before they come here, including Congressman...
No, there's a line we're missing there, isn't it?
I think it's the same line.
Okay.
Same one.
Okay, yep. Very good.
Refugees, before they come here, says Congressman Louis Gohmert. Not only is that false, it flies in the face of other facts, namely the reason we have accepted so few Syrian refugees since 2011 is because of the intense and time-consuming vetting process to screen out possible insurgents. From the Post article from last September, so far the United States has lagged far behind several European countries in its refugee aid efforts, largely due to the time-consuming screening procedure to block Islamic militants and criminals from entering the United States under the guise of being legitimate refugees. The process for a refugee to be resettled is a long, arduous one, with multiple vetting and screenings throughout.
The following is based on the White House website, the State Department's website, and an exhaustive article done by CQ Roll Call. Once a refugee is displaced, the process to become relocated to the United States begins with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. The UNHCR serves as the liaison between the United States and the refugee. Although there are other NGOs and private voluntary organizations who also work with refugees and serve as go-betweens, refugees generally apply through the UNHCR for resettlement, although about a quarter of the refugees apply to the United States directly. Applications are made before the refugee ever sets foot in the United States. The UNHCR does the initial screening, verifying identity and other basic information. All refugees are urged to be registered with the UNHCR to be considered refugees under international law. Once completed, they are passed on to the State Department. Immediately, any Syrian refugee is subject to additional screening through the Department of Homeland Security called the Syria Enhanced Review. Once complete, a U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services official reviews the paperwork. If approved, an interview is scheduled. The U.S. uses the International Organization for Migration for its vetting interviews.
All right, so let me interrupt here. Is it fair to say that he is getting his information from a policy statement or an experience that he's went through? Because it's incredibly detailed what he's saying here.
It's from the, he says it's from the State Department's website and an exhaustive article done by this Roll Call, CQ Roll Call.
Right, so he's relying upon someone else to present his information as objective.
Yes.
That's true. There's a method of, there's a measure of trust that he's exercising.
And we don't know whether they're actually following what their own website says.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I wrong? Help me out.
No.
It's easy to generate a procedure and a methodology that you're going to follow.
Right, if you read it entirely, it's like, oh, okay, well, yeah, I mean, by the time they go through all that, surely nobody's going to be a terrorist that comes in.
Yeah.
You know, they've weeded them all out, and, you know, we're good to go.
Right, I mean, if this is, in fact, what they're doing, who can argue with this?
Right,
mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And because it takes 1 to 3 years to complete it all.
Yeah, I heard 18 to 24 months was your standard vetting process for these refugees.
Right.
Yeah, he says 3 years from the time that they actually say, I'm a refugee, I want in the U.S., till they actually can come to America and be given a home.
I mean, I don't want to bore our listening audience with the rest of the, I mean,
it's very detailed.
Very detailed. And the point is, if in fact they're doing this, then glory to God, we don't even need to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that I have great confidence that the current administration does anything well.
Right.
Like following written policy? Like the Constitution?
Enforcing federal law?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the one safeguard we can say is it's not like they're coming across the Mexican border. You know, we do have to get them from Syria to here.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be something there, but who's to say we're not cutting corners? Who's to say we're not foregoing some of these procedures? Because that certainly is a distinct possibility.
Yeah, and certainly also why we're lagging behind accepting them into our country. As if you were a border state over there and they come across, then you're almost forced to
deal with them.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the comments he makes about the FBI director is just that, you know, if somebody doesn't have a past history or hasn't been flagged anywhere, then sure, they don't have any information on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they would look as though they have a clean record, but they could still, you know, have some ties and just nobody knows about it until, you know, so they're kind of like some of these that were in France, you know, nobody really, they weren't on anybody's radar.
The Agent Smith things in the Matrix, anybody?
But I think what they've come up with is, I think almost all of those guys were European Union citizens. I don't think they were refugees, so that's a whole other issue. That's an Islam issue, that's not a refugee issue.
Right.
I just want to remind the listener that the State Department that is doing this is the same State Department that was okay with Hillary Clinton having all her emails on a private server in the basement of her house.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one thing to develop a policy manual on how you're going to do something. It's an entirely another thing to follow your own policies.
Sure.
So there could easily be a climate whereby our website shows you how well we do it.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, the degree to which we follow our own procedures is not so much.
It's hard not to assume dishonesty on the government's part. Especially, just about everything.
Especially with Eric Holder and the whole gun-running routine.
Yeah,
it's hard to imagine that we're going to be blowing that much ethic standard and then still somehow follow our own vetting process for Syrians.
All right, myth number four, Brian.
Most of the refugees are men of military age. You'll see this myth most often on social media, but it was reported on blogs and elsewhere. The claim that this figure was proven by the United Nations. But the data they are referring to is based solely on the numbers of refugees who are trying to enter Europe, doesn't include any ranges besides men and children, and isn't restricted to Syrians either. This is one of those situations where social media and blogs misread a chart and then run with the idea. The facts are more in line with what you would expect based on the UNHCR's registration data. 22% of the total number of refugees are military-aged males, 18 to 45. Over half the total are women, and more than half of all the males are either younger than 18 or older than 60. There is evidence that many young men in Syria don't want to fight, but they aren't constituting anything close to majority of refugees. In the United States, the numbers are strikingly different. Of those admitted for resettlement in America, only 2% were unmarried men of military age. That's a far cry from the claims of some that were letting in loads of unattached men in their early 20s ripe for radicalization. Myth number five. Posing as a refugee is an easy way to get into the United States. If the facts providing in myth number three didn't make it clear that posing as a refugee is not an easy way to enter America, let's look at the alternatives. Of the confirmed identities of the Paris bombers, we know that three have been identified as French nationals and one as a Belgian national. If they had wanted to carry out these attacks in the United States, they could have easily gotten here through the visa waiver program. 38 countries participate in the United States visa waiver program that's designed to allow for expedited processing of tourists and travelers to the United States. Most of the European Union nations are on there, including France and Belgium. The only other step is paying a fee and an online screening through a DHS database. That's a far easier process than waiting a year or two required to get into the United States as a refugee.
Well, good heavens. Doesn't that kind of make his second point or whatever it was about the vetting process kind of moot then?
So he's saying here that if they really wanted to come to America, they could have come to America because we have an easy way of coming to America.
You know, I think there's a point there is, you know, if I'm going to come in, I'm going to come in illegally. You know, I'm not going to go through a process where I got to jump through 18 hoops. I'm going to go through the process where I have to jump through one hoop. You know, I think that's his point is if they want to sneak across, it'd be easier for them to fly, get into Central America and just walk across the border. That's a lot simpler than having to go through interview after interview after interview in a refugee process.
I see. So you're saying we're focusing on the wrong process.
Right. The thing is, this refugee process is one thing, and we do have to look at it, but if you don't have secure borders, then why is anybody going to go through this route? You know, I'm not saying ISIS wouldn't plant people through this route. I'm sure they're trying every avenue, but if they want to get in the United States, and I know you've probably read different things about the ISIS camps in Mexico and different places in the United States, they're not going to tell you they're coming. They're going to come in illegally rather than go through the legal process of being a refugee.
Yeah, we didn't say much about myth four, but really only 2% fit the demographic that we're really concerned about, then apparently they know the issue too, refugee status issue.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking, if I'm a single Muslim man, I'm going to be scrutinized 100 times more than anybody else that's going through that process. You know, if it's a young woman, if it's a family, if it's that single guy is going to get, that's a red flag right away. So why am I going to go through that process? I'll find another way to get into the country.
You need to know that on Monday night I went to an information meeting at the library downtown on Islamophobia. Okay, and I was there with two other men from our church. And we heard basically a bunch of liberals moan and complain about how Islamophobia is linked to racism. And basically what you're describing is the exact thing they were vilifying in that forum, that the fact that these people are getting extra scrutiny because of their religion is horrible. It's Islamophobia. Well, the fact that the State Department is willing to exercise that amount of scrutiny because they know that the probability of you being a terrorist is greatly increased if you're of a particular religion, then it seems like we should quit the political correct nonsense where, you know what, if you have a certain fear of Islam, it must mean that you're a racist. No. If you have a certain fear of Islam, it could be because typically you have a reason to fear Islam.
Yeah.
Even if it's just perceived, it's perceived.
Right.
Now, the State Department says, in order for us to do our job, we're going to pay special attention to a particular age. Well, what do you call it, fear of a particular age? You know, we're going to start that next, you know, and it turned into basically, and it was interesting, I don't want to get us off topic here, so I'll just say in passing, it's interesting that the guy who got up, first thing he said, he was a Pakistani, he was a Muslim, and the first thing he said is, now, I'm not an expert, a scholar on Islam. Mm-hmm. So right away, it doesn't matter what you read to him out of his own Quran, he's not listening, because his rebuttal is going to be, well, I don't really know much about it.
Yeah.
You know, which, of course, would never pass for a so-called Christian, at least not around here. And then he linked Islamophobia or a special attention to Muslims. He linked that. He said the same states that have anti-Sharia laws, as gringos would say, anti-Sharia laws, he said 80% of them also have tried to have constitutional amendments outlawing traditional marriage. And so it's just oppression, oppression, oppression. You want to hold Muslims down, you want to hold gays down, and oh, by the way, he's even threw this in there. They even are anti-abortion. And so what do you want to do? Is it that you're pro-life? No, you're anti-woman. You know, you don't like women's health, women's rights. Mm-hmm. So the people who oppress women from having abortions are the ones who oppress gays from wanting to get married are the ones who want to oppress Muslims by being afraid of them and making it like their religion is more deadly than others.
Which is a great juxtaposition, Islam and homophobia, right? I mean, because Islam has no problems with homosexual marriage, right? I mean, we don't even bring that up.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of interesting that those two, that they're on the same side of the oppression. That's right. Interesting.
It's almost like Herod and Pilate all over again. So anyway, I don't want to get us off base, but I did want to point out that that's happening here in our Fayetteville, where they're trying to tell you should not give particular mental energy to a person's religion.
Yeah, and it's that same political correctness that, you know, you guys have been through the airports and you see the TSA searching that 75-year-old lady.
Yeah.
The 12-year-old kid. You know, what, in the name of political correctness, we don't want to make it look like we're only targeting certain people.
Right.
But, you know, why are you searching her? She's not a threat. You know, she's not a perceived threat whatsoever. I always think it's hilarious when they search me, because I'm like, yeah, they wanted to sneak something on a plane, and they gave it to me. You know, the guy that everybody stares on when I get on the plane, because I've got to walk like a hunchback down the aisle. You know, it's interesting the people that they choose to pull out of line.
Yeah.
All right, six is Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states aren't taking any refugees. He's going to argue that they are in fact taking them. Number seven.
The Boston bombers were refugees. This one has started to make the rounds because of a Washington Post article with some misleading reporting. There's a big difference between refugees and those who are granted asylum. not the least of which is asylum granted to those already physically present in the United States, whereas refugees are waiting outside to be let in. The Tsarnaev brothers were both granted derivative asylum through their parents, all who traveled to the United States on tourist visas. They were not refugees and did not go through the refugee screening process. The asylum process is similar to the refugee process with a major distinction. The asylee is present in the United States throughout the entire process, even if his asylum request is denied. Refugees aren't, and that's a big difference. Regardless, at the time of their entering the United States, more than a decade prior to the Boston bombings, neither of the Tsarnaev brothers were on anybody's radar, which makes sense, as they were both 15 and 8 at the time. That didn't happen until 2013.
Okay, but in all fairness, though, I think the author is missing the point, and that is that most Americans do not give a rip about what we're calling them. We're calling them refugees because they're coming here from another country. But when the average American says refugee, they're thinking about any foreigner that has the propensity to show violence. That they're concerned about that person, not necessarily the process or the legal jargon.
Yeah, I think. Well, I think what he's saying is, you know, we get kind of myopic, and we're these Syrian refugees, and he's saying, well, and I think he was pointing out with these guys is the more dangerous one is the one that comes over here on a visa and then says, I need asylum.
Sure, right.
That's the one we got to worry about because they're here. The refugees can't come in until we let them in. The asylum guy comes here legally and then says, I can't go back.
Good point. I need
asylum. And he says, that's infinitely more dangerous because they're on American soil. And, you know, we weren't paying attention to him because the kid was 8 years old. You know, the one they caught, the one that's in jail that was just on trial.
That's
he was 8
point.
Years old when he got here. Well, he's not considered a danger at that point. But
clearly
we let him stay here through asylum, and that... You know, and he had benefited everything from America, and yet was radicalized by the time he was, 16, 17 years old.
All right, number 8.
Governors can bar refugees from being placed in their states.
Glad he mentioned this one.
A quick reading of the Constitution, which vests all of the immigration and naturalization powers in the federal government and makes federal law the supreme law of the land, should blow up this argument. Unfortunately, governors from a variety of states, both Democratic and Republican, have claimed that they will prevent Syrian refugees from being located within their states. They don't have the authority to do this. They know they don't have the authority to do this, but it makes for a good headline. The Refugee Act of 1980 authorizes that the number of refugees who may be admitted under this section shall be such a number as the President determines before the beginning of the fiscal year and after appropriate consultation is justified by humanitarian concerns or is otherwise in the national interest. Once admitted to the United States, they are free to move about the country, just like any other legal resident, alien, or citizen.
Hmm.
Even Breitbart,
Breitbart
acknowledges that the governors can't overrule the president.
Yeah. Of course they can't.
It's clearly, of course.
I mean, there's no fences at the state boundaries.
Yeah, it's such political posture.
There you are.
You know,
yeah.
And people have been, it's been all over Facebook and Twitter and everything else. You know, oh, I wish my governor would do this. And then, of course, the liberal side saying, I hate my governor for doing this. It's all just to make a political statement because they have no power.
Popularity vote is all
it is. It's like the representatives that get up there and go, I'm going to repeal Obamacare. Well, by yourself, you're going to repeal Obamacare. You know, it's stuff that people want to hear. And people like to hear, and it's going to get them political points, but there's nothing to it. It's, you know, and I, you know, if you support it, great. And everybody's look. Pat McCrory said we're not taking any North Carolina. God bless him; he's a great guy. He's just doing that to make himself look good to his base. That's all he's doing. You know, even if you agree with him, he has no power to enforce what he's saying.
All right, so 8 myths at this point, I shouldn't be concerned about it at all.
Yeah, the vetting process, I think, is the big thing. Right?
After reading his article, maybe that's what he would think.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there should be no concern whatsoever.
Not with the refugee process. Right.
Right. I mean, with the refugees. But the bottom line is, there is some reason why Americans are concerned.
Sure.
Yep.
I mean, they're bothered.
Yep. And his contention would be, we're just all misinformed.
Yes. Yes, that's what his argument would be.
But, I mean, to his side, he is a conservative, it seems, from a conservative law school, penning for a conservative, you know, message board of something of some kind. So, maybe you're right. Maybe he's just playing politics. But it looks like he is interested in...
No, I would say that he's a man of integrity and that he's really trying to get the truth out.
Yeah, I think he's just saying, let's slow down and look at this logically. I mean, he says down here, you know, some are going to continue to claim that even one bad apple could cause a major attack. And he says it's important to note that no refugees admitted as refugees have ever committed an act of terror in the United States. I mean, you got some statistics there, you know.
Sure.
There's good things to say there. We've had more Americans attack us on our own soil than we have had refugees attack us on our own soil. So... You know, I think it's something we do need to consider and we do need to look at, but I hate the fact that we do this, that you almost have to take a position that either we have to let every refugee in or no refugees in. Like, there's no conversation to be had. And I think that's it's an ignorant way to do things. It's the same thing they did months ago, where either you have to believe every cop is racist or no cops are racist. Well, maybe just some are. You know, maybe there's another way to deal with the problem than just go into these polar extremes every time. I think that's the social media world that we live in, and you know, all you gotta do is look at all the memes that people love to share and put up on Facebook, and this is all you see: extreme and scare tactic and stuff. It's something we need to talk about. It's something that's important,
national security is really important, but it's not the end of the world like some people like to paint it.
Yeah, something that... Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, that I think the thing that bothers me is with, you know, everybody's trying to, or society's trying to shove tolerance down all our throats, and so it's, you know, obviously the more Islamic Muslims that are coming to America, the more power they're going to have.
Sure.
You know, and as they become citizens, they're going to have voting rights, and they're going to have positions
and, yeah,
in the government and authority
and that's
to start making decisions.
What's going
so,
on here?
Okay, so, yeah, sure, okay, if they're not terrorists, but they're going to shape and change the whole fabric of the country even more than it is now.
Yeah, I think and that's the question. Are we going to extend them citizenship? Is this a temporary refugee thing? Is it a, you know, how long does it take? I think those are all the things you got to figure out. Because, yeah, I think if you're talking these numbers, there's
right,
people,
you know,
to be had.
Yeah, 70,000, 85,000
yeah,
in a year. I mean,
I agree.
How many years is it going to be,
yeah,
until there's enough of them that now all of a sudden, you know, they're your governor, they're your,
yeah,
mayor, they're your city council members. And, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, the Christian voice has diminished even more than it is now.
Yeah.
And I think that the politically correct people would say, well, if that happens, that's the whole point of a melting pot. You know, I mean,
right,
you get even Colin Powell is being quoted now as saying, well, so what if your president's a Muslim? You know, what's wrong with being a Muslim president? That's what we're about. And I don't want to get off on that tangent, but that is the mind of Americanism.
Well,
is,
and Ben Carson said the same thing.
Sure.
And they said something, you know, they hit him with, you know, well, you know, would you support a Christian president, not a Muslim president? And he said, I'd support anyone that follows our Constitution.
Right.
Which, okay, you know, I agree with that. But the problem is that someone that is Muslim is going to have a lot harder time following the U.S. Constitution. If they're a true Muslim and based on their beliefs.
As we currently see, or...
Yeah.
Well,
right. Exactly. You know, they're not going to believe in the U.S. Constitution as it was written.
No, and I...
Because it was penned under the auspices of at least men that believed in a God, not Allah.
Christian ethic. Yeah.
No,
right.
But I'm not alone in the opinion that they know how to play multi-generationally. And, you know, a year. That means in 10 years, 700,000, almost a million refugee. So how many would it take before you have people that can amend the Constitution? 50
right.
years? Okay, so what?
Yeah.
They don't think of anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
And since the average, you know, output of children per household
mm-hmm.
is nearing the European level, we're only a couple decades behind it. France is 1.6 children per household. You can't even replace the parents, obviously, at 1.6. So how long does it take with Muslim families? How long does it take before you can now make amendments to the Constitution? And again, liberals would say, well, if that's how it works, it's a government of the people.
Well, I mean, on this, and you've got sort of a case study, I think, with Hispanic immigrants with that very thing. Is, you know, I don't know the exact year that our border security became much less stringent, and we allowed a lot of Mexican and other Central American and Latin American countries to immigrate in. But all of a sudden, they are a larger minority than the African-American population. It didn't take very long. And you know why? Because their birth rate is, much like the Muslims, three times as much as what the black community is.
Right.
And so the black community has shrunk. I think the combination there with abortion in the black community, we
yep.
can't argue those statistics. And their growth has not, they can't replace themselves.
No.
So they're shrinking. The Hispanic groups that come in, largely Roman Catholic,
right.
against birth control, that sort of thing, they're going to have much more children, and so they have blown right by them,
right.
and they're going to be double the size of them in 30, 40 years.
Well said.
And so if you apply that same idea in a different context to Islamic families that are coming in, having 5.6 children or whatever it is,
yeah.
how long does it take before that becomes a pretty commanding voice?
Right.
We're already talking about the Hispanic vote swinging
exactly.
presidential elections right now.
And from the worldwide caliphate perspective, which is what they're after,
you need to define that word.
The caliphate, meaning the government. A caliph is a deputy. That's what the word mm-hmm. means. It's an Arabic word which means deputy. But a caliphate is the idea of a rulership under a particular deputy that could be considered a successor of Muhammad the Prophet. So with this idea,
almost like a kingdom of God idea.
Right, a kingdom of God.
Global Islam.
Right,
yeah.
Global Islam, which would result in Sharia. Okay, for real Sunni Muslims, it would result in Sharia law. So if that's the perspective of Islam, is just wait it out, outpopulate them, change their constitutions, and before you know, that's really today's newborns are they're voters in less than two decades. That is nothing. That is nothing.
to a multi-generationally thinking culture and a multi-generationally thinking religion. It's nothing. 20 years is nothing.
And I think that's what you can gain from this article. That's what we need to be talking about.
Right.
The effects of what this is what we need to talk about. Stop going for sensationalism and let's talk about the reality of all this. You know, some of this isn't important, but we're coming at it at the wrong angle. You know, we've got to figure out what we're going to do. You know, it's like if I'm on the conservative side, I can't even accept an idea of letting a refugee in. If I'm on the liberal side, I can't imagine the idea of not letting every refugee in. But it's just not that simple. That's not what's going on here.
Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, if people are dying and people are suffering, then do we not have some responsibility to try to do something?
Right.
I don't think not letting anybody in is the answer. The question is, how are we going to approach this that does not fundamentally, you know, destroy our society by doing it
okay.
in the name of goodness?
Right, so now let's interject the biblical perspective there, because what you said was primarily from a national perspective, right?
Right.
So then how do I think of this terms from a biblical perspective? Because from a evangelistic perspective, I want refugees coming to America so that I can bring them to Jesus and introduce them to the gospel, that it's much easier to potentially evangelize them if they're on this side of the ocean than they are on that side of the ocean.
Amen.
Right? So how do I balance my desire to maintain a nation state that gives me religious freedoms, which is America, in some form or fashion, with my biblical worldview that demands I need to be making disciples of the Lord?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think that you should ever dismiss the pragmatic side of things, which it seems like what we've been talking about to a large degree, and we should never dismiss that. But I think that there is a silver lining in this. There is something to be celebrated about people that are made in the image of God coming from, you know, an oppressive environment over to, you know, to somewhere where they have rights to, you know, to be able to grow in their knowledge of, you know, just of different cultures, to grow in their knowledge of the way that the world works outside of those communities, where oftentimes it seems like knowledge is probably very tightly controlled. And so, you know, and they're exposed to other things, namely the gospel, which is really awesome. Normally, where Christians would have to have this kind of centrifugal drive.
What word is that?
Centrifugal or centrifugal or however you want to say it.
Wow.
Potatoes, potatoes. Normally, we would have this, you know, this outward drive or this outward command to go out and reach the nations. Now it's kind of, you know, centripetal in nature, and at least in this regard, it's coming to us. And so it's coming to us now,
right.
And that's cool. That's something to be celebrated.
Okay, I want to back up the train because you said that we shouldn't dismiss the pragmatic.
Yeah, it should be examined, right? So count the cost, you know, and we should examine those.
From what perspective, though?
Well, that was my struggle. And, you know, we had an email thread that went back and forth the early part of this week when Pastor Joey, who's not even here to get my back, thank you, said he would still stand. I don't know if you saw if he responded to all, replied to all, but he still would stand on his naturalization of all illegal immigrants, and this is kind of the same, but not exactly the same issue.
I thought it was interesting he's saying that on his way out of the country, though.
Yeah. So, to which I wanted to back up the train all the way, and say, because we have, in my estimation, I could be off here, but we have two competing ideas. One competing idea is that I am given the task by God to protect my family and those he's put into my sphere of influence. And the other competing idea is that I'm to have compassion and help the helpless. And at times it seems that if those two things, it's very hard to let them coexist. Because we're talking about, well, if I have total compassion, like Dave says, let everybody in, there's a chance that there might be a bad apple. And that my other objective, which is protect my family and my nation, is compromised. And so I wanted to go back and find out, okay, where are all the verses in the Bible that talk about this responsibility that if someone comes in my house, I'm going to take a gun and I'm going to blast them into the next kingdom. And I didn't know what to Google in the Bible to find that. So maybe you could help me out. What verses do we have to support the idea that as a father, my main task and goal and job is to physically protect my family from, I mean, yes, I understand that from a pragmatic standpoint. It's built inside of me. I want to do that, but I want to have a verse. Because I see lots of verses about having compassion. Well, what I'm struggling to find is verses that say, protect your nation's borders, protect your home, you know, have those handguns. You know, and I don't know what search words and strength. I mean, I tried everything. Well, you know, I tried refugees. Of course, that's not in there.
And a song came up.
I know that. Was a little Tom Petty yesterday.
No, I'm talking about the Blue Letter Bible. I got out my Blue Letter Bible app. Tried many different versions. Trying to look for words and think of keywords that talked about specifically about, you know, the protection of the home, that idea, and then, you know, refugees and how to treat. And we do know that there are some... there's some verses on how you're supposed to treat sojourners, and you know, but that was given to the nation of Israel. I'm not always quite comfortable just lifting something out of the law and applying it to the United States of America.
Well, I think that something that can be of some immediate help is even just examining the Ten Commandments and how early Jews and their application of the law, it can become helpful in this. For example, don't murder, right? Don't unlawfully take human life. There's an inverse to that that early Jews understood, and that even, you know, Christians understand today, is that there's a sanctity about human life that we should protect whenever and wherever we can. And so I think that just an immediate reference, obviously there's places that we could go to in the Old Testament that, you know, that are explicit in reference to preserving human life. But I think in that, you know, the Ten Commandments does have that inverse. You know, a lot of the times the commandments are written in a negative way, but the inverse is also true, and we should also uphold that. So whatever that looks like, you know, whatever, don't kill, right? The inverse of that is protect human life, and so it shouldn't surprise us when we see things like build a fence around the roof of your house so that people don't fall off the top of it.
Yeah.
It shouldn't surprise us, right? And so naturally, you know, we can go through and, you know, and because that's how early Jews understood it, that's how Christians understand it today, I think that I'm sure other people have references, but this just off the top of my head, an easy way that we could, you know, that we could say, okay, well, what does that look like for 21st century America, you know?
I'd like to reference Pastor Sean's Sunday morning message, particularly because I can't think of a better way to love my neighbor as myself than to give the gospel. But I do think that the Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, uttermost parts of the earth is based off of love your neighbor as yourself. What better way to love your neighbor than to give them the gospel? And if those two are related, I don't know how I can skip over echelons of neighbors to help one that's coming from 7,000 miles away. In other words, my first neighbor is my wife, then my children, then my next door neighbors, people in the body of Christ that live near me in my church. I can't fathom skipping over echelons of caring and loving my neighbors so that I can, quote, love my neighbors myself from 7,000 miles away. I think that is indicative of this person X mentality. I can love someone I don't know because it doesn't cost me anything right now to theorize about how much I would love them if I did know them. If I'm going to care for my neighbors myself, I'm going to start with the neighbor I spend my most time with, my wife.
Right.
And then my geographical neighbor.
Okay, so the idea, the implication then is that if I think in terms of, if I'm the little boy in the house instead of the father, then I would want my father to protect me from the predator coming in.
Right.
Sure, and we all understand that. But I want to introduce another thought, which is, let's give a scenario. There is a clearly unconverted person, and I have to make a decision. I can only make one. I've got my son who I know is converted, going to go to heaven if he dies, and I got this clearly unconverted person. Now I'm making more than just a decision about, I'm just choosing a eternal destiny. And we know, of course, there's all kinds of facets to this, but I'm just saying there's implications that go beyond just mere protection of the home, because, you know, the moment I pull the trigger and take that man's life, then I know that I have been immediately, not responsible, but I have been an agent to stop any more time for him to make a decision for Christ.
Yeah, but honestly, again, referencing our most recent scripture messages that we've heard preached, I do not see Jesus using that as a determining factor as to how urgent he acts in the life of another. I mean, the rich young ruler, he does not chase him down the beach.
to get him to change his mind.
Sure. And I guess my thing is, when I was thinking about this in preparation for this, I didn't find a lot of scriptures that addressed this specific issue. I mean, am I missing something?
I would say to you, John, that your point is really well taken, which is to take a human life is a big deal. So we should be very cautious in the degree to which we use lethal means to protect our family. So much so, for example, I could have a AR-15. Is that the name of it from the civilian perspective?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, I could have that. I am very familiar with that weapon. I could use that weapon inside and out. But I choose instead to have a shotgun in my house, and I choose to have buckshot in my shotgun. Why? Because there's a much slimmer possibility that if I discharge that I will kill the person. And all I'm trying to do is deter them from doing further harm to those that I love. So I think your point is super well taken, which is it is not preferred for a Christian to kill someone because you are ending their life. And yes, Bill, you're right. The Lord Jesus did not chase after the rich young ruler. That is very, very, very true. But I don't want to live with it on my conscience that I killed someone. I think that's a heavy thing to know that you're personally responsible for sending somebody into.
And I think also, you know, I don't want to even live with the glorification in some otherly realm. And I think I referenced in the email, you know, country songs like, you know, you're boot up and we're going to, you know, kill them all, let God sort them out, and language and posturing like that, which is big deal in the South. I mean, we use that language a lot. You know, you see it on trucks, and I think the one I put in the email was, if you're not willing to stand behind the troops, feel free to stand in front of them. I see those all over Fayetteville. And at first you're like, yeah, oh, wait a minute. I better rethink that reaction there that I have.
And that's why I think it's very difficult to find the balance between, because if loving my neighbor as myself, if that's what my primary commandment is, then every refugee is welcomed into America.
I mean, I think it's, you know, to quote my buddy Tertullian again, you know, what hath Athens to do with Jerusalem? I know we vote, and we should make our voices heard, but do we trust God or not? Is God sovereign or not? And oftentimes we vote, and God chooses for the election to go the other way. So what do we do at that point? So what if we stand up and we make this point, and President Obama gets his way, and 70,000 Syrian refugees show up.
Then we, as a church, minister to them.
We better love them. That's what we better, you know. And I trust God that He is in control of the situation. I now have 70,000 new neighbors that I have to love as myself. It might not be ideal. It might not be what we want. We may not agree with it. But do we trust God or do we not trust God? I think that's what it comes down to for me. Is I'm going to stand up and I'm going to have my voice heard and I'm going to cast my vote. And if God chooses to go, let the country go in the other direction, it doesn't change anything. You know, God's still on the throne, and I still trust Him.
Well, every indication seems to be that He is things going the other direction.
Seems that way. And I'm really not all that despondent about it. I mean, you know, I'm disappointed in a lot of things, but I think the book tells us it's going to get worse before the end.
And that was my other biblical question. We've been talking a lot about population and how the Muslim population is growing, even worldwide. Anybody in here maybe can address from a biblical standpoint and our view of end times, how does that play in? I don't see that a lot. I don't see a Muslim domination of the world. Am I missing that too?
I wish the listener
could
see that.
We're all looking at
Bill. Yes, I wish. You're
the
one that's got a
Revelation
book.
Published. And thanks to God, Revelation was written 600 years before the Quran, so 500 years, so it doesn't have much to say about it.
But you know, when people get all up in arms and they get real worried about this, you know, Putin's going to come down from the north and Obama, and then, you know, the United States is going to, you know, I stood out here and listened to a guy for like an hour trying to get away from him, telling about how all the left states are going to be taken over by, you know, China, and all the middle states are going to be taken over by this, and, you know, he just really had it planned and out, and I walked away thinking, that doesn't sound anything like Revelation to me.
Well, the thing is, I've seen so many, in my short life, so many things come and go. I guess the most recent one is you know, the Russian president is obviously pro-Shiite. And the up until recently, the only thing that was Shiite Muslim in the Middle East was Iran. And now Iraq is basically Shiite government. And they are fighting against a Sunni entity in Syria. Russia is. So pretty soon you're going to have this trilateral, you know, Shiite front that's right on the doorstep of Israel. And why is Russia fighting? Because they have the possibility here of being on the border of Israel through Syria, just simply through this Shiite domination that's now shaping up there across Iran, Iraq, and Syria. So for the first time in a long time, there is a feasible way that Gog and Magog, once again, can be on Israel's front porch. But like I said, you know, 20 years ago, it would have been a different character, a different scenario. So I don't subscribe to the W.A. Criswell thing where you read the Bible with a newspaper in the other hand. I'm sorry, I don't do that. You know, I see too much cyclic activity. I know that just makes the dispensationalists cringe, but I don't see a progression of evil. You find a Christian in the 900s, and they would laugh at what we see as progressing evil. It's cyclic. It's very cyclic. And that doesn't make me a relativistic person, but it does mean that I'm an American that's in a country that's less than 300 years old, and maybe we are seeing our Judeo-Christian foundations leaving. If we're willing to talk about it within the context of a nation, fine. But in the context of church history, we are not seeing it worse now than it's ever been. That is a lame, misinformed statement, church-wide, globally. So,
sure, what did Christianity look like during the Dark Ages?
Right.
Or even, you know, 50 A.D.?
Yeah.
I mean, the numbers were a lot less then. Mm-hmm. Worldwide.
Well, we shouldn't be surprised that things are cyclic. Our entire book of Judges is cyclic, right? And we can't understand Judges without seeing cycles. So why in the world would we have a resentment towards a cyclic understanding of pendulum swings, if I can use that idea, back and forth between periods of righteousness and everything with Israel is like that. I mean, and end times or the reconciliation of those two existences.
Right. And Plymouth would never have happened if you had dispensationally minded people who just resigned themselves to the last day scenario. We never would have had the Mayflower, ever.
You would have just sat still. Yeah.
Right.
And I think the Judges connection is a good one to America, too, if you just kind of make a comparative study there. You know, regional guys pop up out of different parts of a very disjointed Israel. You know, and if anything, the United States is pretty disjointed right now. You know, and you got a guy talking over here, and then he'll raise up over here for a little while, and then another one raises up over here for a while, and they just tend to get progressively worse as the years go on. You know, I don't know if we're quite to Samson yet, but we seem to be moving in that direction.
Yeah, where Christians are just annoyances and not so much movers and shakers anymore. It's basically how Samson is portrayed. He's just kind of a pain and never really led a nation to the Lord.
Right.
The reality is what the early church was involved in, which was prayer and preaching the gospel, it's just not that sexy.
Right. Yeah.
It's just not. I mean, it's so much more to be concerned about the court systems, to be concerned about job opportunities, to be concerned about neighborhoods, to be concerned about playgrounds, to be concerned about refugees. I mean, that is just so much more relevant, pragmatic, current, and all that.
And I would submit it's because of pride, because we want to feel like we're important and part of something. That's why we don't want to be this dispensationalist. It's, you know, here's where it's headed, and we're in the last days. You know, we're somebody special.
We make it happen.
We don't want to be mundane.
Well, we certainly
like
don't.
All the other humans that lived and died.
We certainly don't want to have a plan of salvation where God gets all the glory.
Right.
That's right.
I mean, we have to have some part. Rich young ruler, you brought him up. Mm-hmm. You know, the disciples go, who can get saved? I mean, that's their conclusion.
Well, that's when I even try.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he says, well, with men, it is impossible.
Right.
I mean, he doesn't say, no, boys, it's a joint effort. Let me get you riled up again. We can do this together. No, he just reinforces their perspective. You're right. With you, it is impossible. Yep. But with God, all things are possible.
Yep.
And he takes them right back to God. And that's where David took us in our discussion, which is Do you trust in God or not? Is God capable of protecting or not? Is God capable of guiding or not? Is God so handy in his marvelous provision and protection that he could guide a bullet in a theater if you were in there?
And when were we promised protection? When did that happen?
Well, Psalm 91, jerked out of context. For every
Surely he does protect. I'm not disputing that, but he also said you're going to be persecuted. He also said you may give your life for this. You know, that there's no guarantee of prosperity and protection. That's modern Christianity. That's not biblical Christianity.
Well, there's no question to me when we were in First Samuel, the end of First Samuel, going into Second Samuel, and David eulogizes Saul and Jonathan, that David. I mean, David, no more than anybody else in the Bible, recognizes God's sovereignty. I mean, God gets the credit for everything. I mean, David doesn't back away from that at all. But at the same time, he gave great human responsibility to the man that you know, killed Saul. And, you know, and he slew him because, you know, and it was just amazing to me because we see both. It's like,
you know, I agree with you 100%. I'm going to take us, and this just jumped off the page for me this week, Matthew 26, with the issue of Judas. And it is just startling, the reconciliation of providence and the sovereignty of and the human responsibility. And this is, let's see, I'm looking for the Judas statement right there with woe to the ones betrayed. Is it like 24? Let's see, Matthew 26.
26, 23 and 24.
Yeah, I got this tiny little. Yeah, he says the Son of Man goes as it is written of him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is going to happen. This is ordained. It goes this way. And, okay, well, that means that Judas was doing God's will. Mm-hmm. Right. And then he goes on to say, "But woe to that man to whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man had he not been born." He doesn't give him a pass. He does. He is doing exactly. I mean, Judas was chosen. He was chosen. He's one of the chosen. He's chosen, and he does exactly what God's will is, or somehow he does, right? Because he does what is written.
And so does Caiaphas, and so does Pilate.
Yep.
Right. And yet nobody is given a pass.
Mm-hmm.
You're held accountable. Your human response still matters. He says, woe to that man. It would have been better for him not even. I mean, I saw people on the internet saying he's in heaven. How in the world could he be in heaven? It would have been better for that man not to have been born.
Yeah.
That man can't be in heaven.
Well, you got one of Bart Ehrman's favorite is that Gospel of Judas, right? Where Judas is the chosen instrument of God, and one of those facetious Gospels there that are fallacious Gospels there that make him the hero of the whole thing. So there is a tradition of that.
Yeah, I think he's actually the one who dies on the cross, isn't he?
Maybe it's the same one.
It seems like it. So. But I think this is really big, since you just can't choose 2 Peter. I think that this statement here influenced Peter so much, in the second epistle specifically, that he was probably, while he's dealing with Balaam and other false prophets, there's no question in my mind that the biggest exhibit A for Peter was Judas, when at the end of second chapter he says it'd been better to not to know the way of deliverance than to have known it and to turn back. You know, I think that is almost really lockstep with the statement of Christ here, but Christ said it'd been better for him not to have been born. You know, mm-hmm. But I think Peter was greatly influenced with his time with Christ, saw Judas, and much of his epistle on false prophets was based off of his experience with Judas, where he spent 3 years with this guy apparently casting out demons, apparently healing sick people in the lot.
Yeah, I'm going to do my very best Sunday morning to try to magnify the reality that Judas was an apostle.
Yeah. In every sense. Yeah.
In every sense. There's nothing in the biblical narrative that should cause us for even a moment to think that Judas was doing anything less than everybody else.
It was always the 12.
Right. Right. Sending out all this. There's nothing. All the way to the point they're at the table together and they're looking around and saying, is it I? Is it me? Because everything that you read in John, everything is back in there. Everything is read back into the narrative. Well, he's stealing. They didn't know he's stealing at the time. That's parenthetically inserted, if I can use that expression. So,
if they would have known that, he wouldn't have been carrying the money back.
That's exactly right.
Or sitting close. I mean, he was sitting right next to Jesus.
Right
on the left.
Right.
And when he sends him out, that's not out of the ordinary. They don't think anything else.
No, they think that he's going to go buy some more provisions, set the conditions for more things.
Dips it, hands it to him. You know, John's on one side, Judas on the other. Yeah. That's not a mistake. He hands it to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's startling.
Yeah.
We have apostles today that are going to hell.
Right. Judas was probably using that same scheme. I think Judas was closer, at least in his function within the 12, than Peter was because of the placement at the Last Supper. Peter's on the other side of John. He has to ask John what Jesus is saying. And so it's John and Judas and Peter. And so, I mean, he was really tight with the Lord Jesus in that regard.
And I don't think it's an accident at all, Bill. And I'm so thankful that you showed me this, that we have Judas being called friend right after the parable of the man called friend. I don't think that's an accident at all. Back-to-back friend.
Right.
I mean, I think somebody was supposed to pick up on that.
Yeah.
That's just too, that is too linked. 22 and 26, both of them friend.
Yeah.
And Jesus has already said to the guy, you're out of here. Go do what you're going to do.
Yeah.
He sends him out. Go do it. And then he turns around and calls him a friend. You know?
Yeah.
And if that doesn't speak to me, if that doesn't speak for the atonement being universal in its potential application, nothing does.
Right.
He calls him a friend. I mean, it's startling. Stop this nonsense of limiting the atonement in its application.
After washing his feet.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Right, because the feet are washed before we get to this part.
That's right.
It's startling. So it's not an accident. These little points of connection are not accidents.
No way.
Yeah. Well, we certainly have come full circle, and if you're still listening to us, the five of you out there that stood the test of time, thanks for being part of our discussions. We enjoy them, just internally. It helps us as a staff, and we love to share it with you. Give us a comment. Have a great day. Appreciate you listening.